Understanding Islam, a religion with more than 1.5 billion followers. A recent heated debate on the HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher sparked a renewed debate over how many in the West view Islam. The controversial comedian mocked President Obama's claim that the extremist group, the Islamic State, or ISIL, does not represent all of Islam. One of Maher's guests, the actor and director Ben Affleck, called Maher's characterization racist and gross. The exchange, which has gone viral, raises questions about our understanding of one of the world's most popular religions, the dangers of conflating the actions of extremists with the beliefs of a majority of followers, and how to have a discussion about a topic that can lead to uncomfortable questions about a religion many may not be that familiar with. Main Calling answers your questions about Islam, but first, these news headlines. From the MPBN studios, I'm Erwin Gratz, and this is Main Calling. Yesterday afternoon, we received an email from a listener who visited the Main Calling webpage, saw which guests we had lined up for today's show, and determined that program was choosing, quote, to toe the politically correct line, unquote, by not including apostates of Islam on our panel. Despite what our emailer may believe, we are not seeking to do a politically correct program today. We do hope to offer insights into a religion followed by hundreds of millions of people throughout the world and get answers to questions you have about Islam. With me in the studio, Ali Amida. He's a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of New England. Reza Jalali is also with us. He's a writer, educator, and Muslim scholar who has lived in Maine since 1985. He serves as coordinator of multicultural student affairs at the University of Southern Maine. John Michaud is in our studio. He's director and assistant professor of the School of Legal Studies at Hudson University. Joining us from our Bangor studios, Omar Kunte. He's outreach coordinator for the Islamic Center in Orono. As always, we'd like to hear from you. What questions do you have about Islam? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet us at Main Calling or post the Main Calling Facebook page. I want to give you play a little clip for you, a little something that'll give you the idea of kind of what is swirling around Islam these days.
I can show you a Pew poll of Egyptians. They are not outliers in the Muslim world that say like 90% of them believe death is the appropriate response to leaving the religion. If 90% of Brazilians thought that death was the appropriate response to leaving Catholicism, yeah, you would think it was a bigger deal.
I would think it's a big deal no matter what.
Okay, but that's the fact.
You don't. But what I wouldn't do is say it's all Brazilians, or I wouldn't say, well, Ted Bundy did this. Goddamn, these gays are all trying to eat each other. You know?
Yeah, okay, let me just give you what you want. There are hundreds of millions of Muslims who are nominal Muslims, who don't take the faith seriously, who don't want to kill apostates, who are horrified by ISIS, and we need to defend these people, prop them up, and let them reform.
Dude, you're talking, ISIS couldn't fill a double-A ballpark in Charleston, West Virginia, and you're making a career out of ISIS.
But no, it's not just ISIS. It's all jihadists. It's global. It's a phenomenon of global jihad.
I think that's the opposite.
There is those things. There's ISIS. There's global jihadists. The question is the degree to which you're willing to say, because I've witnessed this behavior, which we all object to on the part of these people, I'm willing to flatly condemn those of you I don't know and have never met.
No, it's not condemning people. It's ideas.
And people who believe in those ideas.
And so it's people who believe it, based on reality, Ben.
We're not making it up that in the Muslim world, it is mainstream belief.
But this is such a caricature of Indonesia, of Malaysia, much of the world. And this does have the tinge a little bit of the way white racists talk about African Americans.
That's Nicholas Kristof, the columnist for the New York Times. You also heard Ben Affleck, and the clip we played you is from Bill Maher's program on HBO, Real Time. And there you have it, a very small sample of the debate that sometimes swirls around Islam, a faith I don't know as much about as I do others. So it is time for us to learn from some experts, and that would be all of you. So thank you for joining us. I want to start with Omar. Tell us a little bit about, let's go right to the very beginning. What is Islam as a religion?
Oh, that is a really big question. Islam, to talk about Islam would take a lot, but to boil it down, Islam is a religion that strives to connect between man and God, and through that connection, a person will achieve peace for themselves and peace with God and peace with their surroundings and the world in general, and which is where the name Islam, the word Islam, comes from. It means to submit in peace to the wishes and the will of God. So Islam, when you take the Arabic root of it, it comes from what the root word of peace, salam, which we believe as Muslims that this religion of Islam is based on the idea of achieving peace, not peace only with God, but peace with your fellow human beings and fellow creatures of earth. So, like I said, if you want to go through the details, it'll take a lot, and we don't have much time. But
I understand. That's a good start. How does it emerge in human? Where does it emerge in human history? Very briefly.
Islam does not see itself as a new religion and as a new way of life. Islam sees itself as a continuation of the same message that was given to all the prophets God sent to humanity. May God and peace be, and God's peace and blessings be upon them all. So it does not see itself as something entirely new and separate from all the other religions, for example, Christianity, Judaism. Islam, the Quran says, this book came as a confirmation of the messages and the prophets who came before. And hence, Muslims are mandated as part of their religion to believe in the Bible, to believe in the Torah, to believe in the prophets of Moses, Jesus, Abraham, Noah, Isaac, Jacob, may God's peace and blessing be upon all of them. So Islam sees itself as a continuation, as a finalization of all those religions that have came before.
Okay. Yes, Omar. Yes.
Let me just add another important building on what Omar just said. Islam shares, in summary, not only continuity, but also many, many aspects of the Abrahamic religions, because the three faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, came from the same region, and they all go back to the patriarch Abraham. In other words, that people probably don't know that, but these three faiths, including Islam, which came to us in the 7th century, they not only they have continuity, but they share commonalities about monotheism. And the Quran, since it came in the 7th century, builds on so many aspects of the previous two monolithic religions, including not only recognizing all the prophets, but also, for example, the Virgin Mary. There is a whole verse in the Quran called the Virgin Mary. And Muslims, not only they believe in the narrative, the biblical narrative of Mary, they believe that Mary was a virgin, indeed. Many of our listeners probably, they don't know these things. They just only focus on how different and how unique and how exceptional this faith is. And they forget the whole body of theological, religious, and also historical ties that tie these three religions, including Islam.
Okay, John Michaud.
I think that it's very true that the religions have very much in common. And yet, I think the core of the matter is we're not talking about Christianity, we're not talking about Judaism, we're talking about the Islam religion because, unfortunately, it has been perverted by some, not by all. I would never paint with that broad a brush, but we have a fear. We Americans have a fear of the perversion of the religion. I certainly would not take the stand that all Muslims are terrorists, but in the last 15 years, all the terrorist acts against the United States have been Muslim-driven, and I don't believe it's the religion, but a perversion of the religion.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that's true is that we've been talking about the fact that probably a lot of Americans don't know much about Islam, and so there's always a natural trepidation, perhaps fear, of what we don't understand. Omar, I think you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to add to that the fear is something that is shared by all, especially for Muslims, because if we really step back and look of the atrocities and the horrific things that people, groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Boko Haram and people as such, the horrific acts that they commit daily against humanity, most of it is perpetrated against Muslims, their own fellow Muslims. So that fear is something that is shared across all people, be they Muslims or otherwise. I agree that the aspect of the religion has been perverted to the extent that people cannot, you know, adequately differentiate between, you know, what is actual Islam and what these people sort like ISIS and them perpetrate and propagate around the world. And I think that, you know, we all need to step back and look at the bigger picture and try to seek more knowledge around this area in order to gain a better understanding of what's going on in the world.
Well, I think something that's appropriate to ask about at this point, Ali, you mentioned before, of course, Islam's connections to Judaism and Christianity. And there are many similarities, but there are clearly some differences. What are the major differences, the things that set Islam apart from those religions? Reza?
Well, before I answer that question, it just really breaks my heart to see my faith, Islam, which has given the world the alphabet itself, an Arabic word, the modern numerical system, including zero, another Arabic word, the gifts of astronomy, naming the stars we love and adore so much, the use of lenses in modern cameras, that it has contributed so much to humanity and was its message was based on tolerance and acceptance and equality of men and women, being so misunderstood in the West and in particular in the U.S. I would argue that we cannot judge an entire community of some 1.6, 1.8, both numbers are offered members of one community, Muslims from Indonesia, from China, from Russia, all the way to Canada, by actions and a few criminals. I would argue that every faith, including Christianity, has had and continues to have its radicals, its extremists, you name them, anything you want, the fundamentalists, and who have used violence or advocated for violence to reach their political goals. We have our own share. In Islam, we have our own share. And I feel it's really unjust that we focus on actions as few. I would ask the audience and the guests, what are the number of these criminals who use Islam, who have hijacked my peaceful religion to reach their own goals? What is the number that we can count on? Can we say they are 100,000, 200,000, 4 million, 10 million criminal Muslims? So even at 10 million, that's a tiny, tiny representation of a larger peaceful community. People tell me that Islam is a religion of the Middle East, and I argue that I would offer this information that the largest, the first five, six Muslim countries in terms of population, the largest countries are all non-Arabs. That this is a religion of countries such as Indonesia, Malaysia, Tunisia, Morocco, and Tajikistan. And do we always hear bad news about these countries? So the media tends to report what is awful. And again, it's, I would also add that this is the political Islam. This is the militant Islam getting all the attention, where majority of Muslims who go to war, go to school, work and pray, and want the same thing as non-Muslims want, a shelter, food, access to healthcare, sending the children to school, would continue to live normal lives, and we hardly hear about them.
Okay, fair enough. But I do want to go back to my question so we can deepen people's understanding. What is it that separates Islam from the other faiths? Ali?
Well, there are, of course, there are theological differences in addition to the similarities that we always forget about, but also the fact that we know that the vast majority of Muslims live in Africa, the Middle East, and also Asia. These societies went through colonization for the last 200, 300 years. They strive for self-determination. They try to have their own, choices in governance and building their own societies. And there is legacies, political legacies, I would say, not religious legacies, of colonization and exploitation. And there is that kind of what I call the clash of ignorance, where people, when they don't know the other, they haven't met somebody, they haven't talked to somebody, they just read something or listened to somebody agitating or somebody burned the Quran or somebody really, gave a very, very negative view of American society and so. And therefore, they want to generalize about it. And that really heightened the animosity and the differences. And instead of bringing and bridging people together, and also at the same time learning, listening, instead of really pointing fingers at the different directions, or worse, taking a nasty, violent extremist group and say, this is really, there's a problem with this faith. There's a problem with this culture. And I call it mutual ignorance.
If I could address the question about what is the difference, what would be the difference between Islam and the other religions?
Sure.
Of Christianity and Judaism. We talked about some of the similarities. The biggest difference separating Islam and Christianity, for example, is the position of who Jesus, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, is. Mm-hmm. This is the biggest sticking point of separation between these two faiths. Christians, some would say, Jesus is the Son of God. Some would say he's more than that, he's God himself. Islam says no. He's neither one of those, but he's a prophet and a messenger of God, just like Moses, just like Abraham, just like Muhammad, just like Ishmael, just like Joseph, and all the other prophets that I mentioned in the Bible and in the Quran. He's one of those. And this is the difference between the biggest difference between these two faiths. And as Muslims go on to even believe to the point that Jesus will be returning in this world, Muslims believe that Jesus was born miraculously without a human father. Jesus spoke as soon as he came out of the womb in the cradle to defend his mother, her honor and her integrity against accusations that she was a streetwalker. Jesus went on to perform dozens and perhaps hundreds of miracles in his life. And the difference comes in that Muslims believe that he is able to perform these things through the aid and the help of God, not because of his own power, not because of his own ability. But he's not God, nor is he God's son, but he's a mighty prophet, just like all the other prophets were, and had the same duties and responsibilities of carrying the message of God to the people that he was sent to. So this is the biggest difference between Christianity and Islam. But otherwise, when it comes to, believing in the oneness of God, when it comes to believing in scriptures, Muslims have to believe, as mandated in their religion, that a person cannot be a Muslim if they reject the Bible as a scripture from God. They cannot be a Muslim if they rejected Jesus, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, as a messenger of God. They cannot be a Muslim if they reject Moses. They cannot be a Muslim if they reject any of the prophets that God has sent. So Islam is the only non-Christian religion that makes it an article of faith, as a mandate to believe in these things. So again, the biggest difference between these two religions are the position and who Jesus is.
All right.
We
have a lot more conversation to come. We have phones that have been lit up pretty much since we went on the air. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, some of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Cabot Creamery, whose Maine dairy farmers welcome visitors to sample regional cheeses and craft beers at their Old Port Annex in Portland, and Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, many say Turkey's direct involvement is critical to the coalition's fight against ISIS, but Turkey is asking for more protection near its border with Syria. Understanding Turkey's role in the region and the militant group's growing reach.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock. MPBN is a media sponsor of Bela Fleck, Abigail Washburn, and the Del McCoury Band in concert, presented by Portland Ovations on Saturday, November 1st at Portland's Merrill Auditorium. Fleck and Washburn have been deemed by NPR as the unofficial first family of the banjo. MPBN members are eligible for a 10% discount on tickets to the show. For more information about the MPBN member discount tickets, visit mpbn.net and click on Events.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, we're talking about one of the world's oldest and most popular religions, Islam. With me in the studio, Reza Jalali, coordinator of multicultural student affairs at the University of Southern Maine. John Michaud is director and assistant professor of the School of Legal Studies at Hudson University. Ali Hamida is professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of New England. And joining us from our Bangor studios, Omar Conte, Outreach Coordinator at the Islamic Center in Orono. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. So let us go to the phones. And we'll start with Henry in Otisfield. Henry, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you. I spent 23 years working in international humanitarian relief, and most of those years were spent in Islamic countries, all the way from Pakistan, Afghanistan, to Morocco. I know what Islamic societies are like, and it really hurts me when I hear the bigotry that is floating around this country explaining Islam. If you want to know what Muslims are like, get to know your Islamic neighbors and colleagues, and you'll find that they are gentle, open, sweet people. In all those years traveling in these countries, I never met one of these wackos. They represent a very small percentage. But when people are willing to do anything to do what they want done, a very small percentage can raise international havoc. I'd also like to say concerning religion that I have worked in Christian countries, Islamic countries, Hindu countries, animist countries, and Buddhist countries. And if you look at a truly religious person in any of those societies, and you judge them on how they behave, how they treat their families, how they treat the environment, you can't tell one from the other.
Fair enough. Anybody want to comment on that?
I think this is, Henry, thank you for your very, very, very moving description of your experiences. I think this goes back to the point I tried to mention earlier, which is when we have to ask ourselves before we make any judgment, what are the sources of our news? Do we know people? Have we met them? Have we get to know them? And I think time and again we'll find that Muslim societies, like everybody else, they are flawed, they are complex, they are humane, they are good, and they are bad. And I think this it will really happen only through personal experience and also interaction with the people as a human being, and not just being boxed in cliche that would really, be reproduced and say there is this extreme group or this violent group or this nasty group and they represent everybody. I think you're going to find in Muslim societies, like in our society in the United States, group that are very, very violent, very extremist, very intolerant. And I think Muslim society have their share of that. But also, how often we hear of the stories of the majority of everyday society, everyday family. We don't hear about it. Only we hear the sensationalist extremist groups who are real, but whether they represent the majority or not, this is a question that we need to ask ourselves very hard.
Yeah. Reza.
We also need to remember that there's diversity in Islam, the diversity of worldviews and political thoughts and so on and so forth. For example, a worldview of a Kuwaiti Muslim has to be different than that of a Muslim living in, say, Albania or in Turkey. And why would we expect otherwise? So, again, what we see in the Middle East, in turbulent Middle East, it's really very complex. It's a legacy of the colonial powers, as Ali said, but it's also a legacy of the Cold War conflict that the Middle East was neatly divided between the two superpowers, with some governments being in the camp of the Americans and others with the Russians. And since then, we could also add the issue of oil, our natural resources. Many of us in the Middle East call oil the black curse because it has caused conflicts. It has invited unwanted guests, mostly Europeans and Westerners, to come in search of oil and divide and rule. So it's a very, very complex issue.
Can you explain too, your talk here makes me ask this question because it just comes up so much in the news. The two different branches of Islam, Sunni and Shia, what are the differences between them?
Theologically speaking, it happened right after the Prophet of Islam passed away. And the question was who would succeed him. And the Sunnis, or the majorities, believed that it had to be based on popular vote, consensus, and they were looking for a political leader as well as a spiritual leader. The Shias, the minority in Islam, Shias make up about 15 to 17% of all the Muslims, and the rest are Sunnis. And the Shias believed otherwise. They thought that it should be determined by blood, that the Prophet's son-in-law and his first cousin, Ali, had to be the person taking over. And the difference started from then on. But I have to also mention that when it comes to practicing Islam, we do the same thing. We fast the same way. We go to the same mosque. We pray the same way. We read the Holy Book exactly the same way. And although now it's become a political issue, initially it was really a theological one. And till recent times, with the exception of one or two communities, Sunnis and Shias were intermarrying, were sharing neighborhood and workplaces. And by the way, that continues in a number of Muslim countries, if not in all. And sadly, outsiders who came to the Middle East at one time or the other, again, to reach their own political goals, created this division and perhaps reinforced the differences and highlighted.
Okay, that's helpful. Let's go to Steve in Orono. Steve, good afternoon. You're on Main Calling. Steve, hello?
Hi
there.
Sorry about that, yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to touch upon the previous call for this one. That, yeah, I agree with the bigotry of religion. I don't think you can revert a religion. I believe what happens is people pervert their causes. Everybody wants a life where they have some future, they have some hope, that they don't feel like the world is against them. And so what happens is the folks of these causes pervert their cause, saying that it's in the Quran or it's in the Bible. And so, you know, he is with us, God, or a higher power is with us. So they pervert the cause and recruit using the religion, and then the media jumps on it. I mean, we never said Timothy McVeigh was a radical Christian. We never said that the IRA members were radical Catholics or radical Protestants. But somehow, as in this media world that we're in now, you know, I think that the media is as culpable as anybody, that they have highlighted that because it sells newspapers, it sells cable TV shows, and I think that people, no religion is different than any other religion. There are still people who feel that they want a good life, that they want to be happy, that they want to live with their neighbors and friends, and that's what it is. But causes are perverted and use religion as a recruitment tool, because what a better cause would it be if it's in the Bible or if it's in the Quran, and that he or a higher power is with us in our fight. And I think that's what I see this as.
Okay. I want to get a response from John Michaud.
Sure. I think that there are some good points made. The IRA did what they did for nationalism. There was a political reasoning. What we're looking at are a group of people, not a total group of people, who are doing what they are doing and wrapping themselves in the name of God when they do it. And any historian will tell you that more people have been killed in the name of God than for any other single reason. Certainly, you know, the group of Muslims who are doing this and saying they're immediately going to be saved, they'll immediately go to heaven, they stole that from the Christians. When we sent the Christian crusaders to the Middle East to capture Jerusalem, Pope Urban, Pope Benedict, they were all telling the crusaders, if you die killing the infidel, you will have all your sins forgiven, all your family will have their sins forgiven, you will go to heaven. So it's not particular to any single religion. The question is, why has it continued for so long, and why is it growing in the threat? I could go to the cathedral here in Portland and try and get a group of people to put on suicide vests and walk to the main mall. I probably wouldn't get many takers. And yet, these people who are, and I say perverting the religion, I don't mean to antagonize anybody when I say that, but they can actually get people to do that. Certainly, historically, the Christians would do it, but not now. It doesn't seem they would do it now.
Let's take another short break, and when we return, we've got more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, committed to regaining mobility and getting rid of the pain, jointsme.org, and the Franco Center Gala and Benefit Concert with Entertainment, Wine, and Food November 8th. Details at francocenter.org.
On the next On Being.
I actually have no idea how people manage to be preachers without being stand-up comics first. It's like they come to the truth from a different angle than most people, but people can still recognize it as the truth. And I think a good preacher does the same thing.
Nadia Bolz-Weber, Lutheran pastor of the House for All Sinners and Saints. I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us.
Tune in for On Being, Sunday morning at 6 a.m. Last night, MPBN Radio and Television aired our Your Vote 2014 Senate debate, which you can see anytime online at mpbn.net. We'll also rebroadcast that debate this afternoon at 1 here on MPBN Radio. That's immediately following Maine Calling. And Sunday afternoon at 5 on MPBN Television. Tonight, MPBN hosts our Your Vote 2014 gubernatorial debate, to which all the candidates have been invited. We'll rebroadcast that debate Friday, tomorrow afternoon, here at 1 on MPBN Radio, and then Sunday evening at 6 on MPBN Television. All of our debates, the Maine Calling candidate conversations, candidate profiles, and the issues comparison grid are available online at mpbn.net. Just click on Your Vote 2014.
And welcome back. I'm Erwin Gratz. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Islam. With me in the studio, John Michaud, director and assistant professor of the School of Legal Studies at Hudson University, Reza Jalali, a writer, educator, and Muslim scholar who has lived in Maine since 1985, Ali Hamida, who is a professor in the Department of Political Science at UNE with us in our Bangor studios, Omar Conte, outreach coordinator at the Islamic Center in Orono. And of course, you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Ali, you wanted to follow up on John Michaud's comment.
Yes, and I think we'll find many, many examples in Judaism and Christianity and now in Islam, and I may say also in other religions, including, Buddhism and Hinduism, where people will, for political reasons and contemporary motives, will go to the traditions or the religious texts and find justifications for purely expedience reasons. And I think in that case, extremist violent groups now in the Middle East and the Muslim world are not really an aberration. What we need to ask is, why these movements now? Why in the last 30 years? Why not before? What kind of internal, regional, and international factors that led a group, a very fringe interpretation of Islam, Wahhabism, which was confined to Saudi Arabia, even in Saudi Arabia only to the region of Najd, that became really, was a fringe part of the whole Muslim world, not representative, to become really an international thing. Al-Qaeda will emerge, and the Taliban regime will emerge to speak for the larger Muslim community. This is the question that we need to ask. And I think also we need to ask, where is ISIS or ISIL come from? What contribute it tries now, not as it claims to be this is the true Muslim voice? Anybody will say that, from Jim Jones to the settlers in Israel to all groups. They say we are really the voice of God on earth. And I think we shouldn't be fooled by that. That's the key question. And also, as we see in our own society, people who are conservative, people who are liberal, people who are really a very, very ultra-conservative. We have diverse, states from Mississippi to Alabama to New England to Maine to what have you. The Muslim world has the same thing. You have the conservative Saudi Arabia. You have the liberal and the moderate and Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and Tunisia and so. And I think that diversity is a discovery goal. I wish that our listeners began to really investigate and discover. And that would really dispel the myth about extremists representing Islam.
Right. Let's go to Bill in Durham. Bill, good afternoon. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. I have a question relating to modernizing Muslim attitudes towards women. It seems that that the radicals have a precedent in the life of Muhammad, who, of course, had numerous wives, including supposedly one of his favorites was, or if not the favorite, a 13-year-old. So how do Muslim modern clerics address the radicals who say, we have a wonderful precedent in the founder of our religion?
Reza?
Well, my response to that would be, if you were to go back to the birth of this faith, we see that women and men were treated equally. In fact, I would start with reading you, quoting a surah from the holy book of Islam, and it starts with, O people, we have created you from a male and a female. And it continues saying, we have made you into nations and tribes so that you may come to know one another. But the beginning of the surah is quite powerful. 1,400 years ago, almost 1,400 years ago, a new religion talks about equality between man and woman. It says, we created you from a single soul. It doesn't say men are superior to women. And in practice, the prophet's own wife is an independent businesswoman, and she acts as a mentor to the prophet himself. The prophet's, peace be upon him, his daughter accompanies him in important battles, Fatima, and so on and so forth. And then we come to the role of Sufi poets and all women and Muslim women and leaders. To give an example, Rabia of Basra, she was born a few hundred years before Rumi. And she had a large following. She was able to write poetry and read her own poetry in public without any protest. and poetry, which is very inclusive, which today, 100 years later, we still can relate to. I'll quote one. In my soul, there is a temple, a shrine, a mosque, a church where I kneel. Very powerful words. So we see that, and in contrast, we come to an age, an era when in the Taliban-ruled Afghanistan, they decide, the men decide that half of the population cannot attend a school or walk outside. I would argue as a scholar that this is a cultural and political and tribal issue more than a religious issue, and that the Taliban, a group of men, very violent men, decide that half of the population needs to be silenced and marginalized. And we have Christian fundamentalists who would agree with that, and they have that in common with the Taliban. And so I would say that contrary to what many, many non-Muslims think, that Islam needs to be reformed, modernized, as you said, when it comes to treatment of half of its population, I would say Islam has started quite well. Sadly, the men who are in power, be it in Iran, the Ayatollahs, be it the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, the Taliban, the Al-Qaeda, those are the ones that women need to fear, not Islam itself as a faith.
Okay. Bill, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. This is an email we received from Bob Crispin, who is asking for a discussion of the difference between hariba and jihad. And he asks, why is there not use of hariba or hirabi when referring to terrorists who act outside the more precise definition of jihad? Omar, is that something you can help us with?
What was the other word he mentioned?
It's hiraba or hirabi.
Hirabi.
I don't know what that's supposed to mean.
In Arabic, it means war. Harab.
It means war.
Harab. Harab.
It means war. Harab. It's just harab. It's loose harab. Translation of
war. War. Yes.
War.
War and jihad.
War. War and jihad. Jihad. It has a broad definition, and sadly, in this day and age, people tend to understand it as holy war, and that is inaccurate in many ways. The word jihad means a struggle for good. And struggling of any kind, you waking up in the morning, going to make an earning in an honest way for your family is jihad. A person going to school struggling to earn a degree in order to get a better life for themselves and their family is jihad. Any type of struggle to do good is jihad. And that is the jihad, the struggle of the self. That is the biggest jihad. The struggle against the own soul, your own inclinations, your own desires, your own temptations and evilness about a person, that is the single biggest jihad that a person faces in their life. And another component, jihad can come in a form of an armed conflict. But that definition is very narrow in Islamic religion. And there comes a time where people have to stand up and fight. But that jihad is very narrow and very restrictive. If you look at it in history of Islam and in the literatures of Islam, to a point that there's a time that, you know, Prophet Muhammad was getting ready, it's a narration that he was getting ready to go to battle. And a man came to him and he said, I would like to join you. And he asked the man, is your mother alive? The man says, yes. He says, go home and take care of your mother. That is your jihad. So our understanding of jihad as this great holy war is very inaccurate. We have boiled it down to something very, 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 very small and not a very big part of the religion at all. But yes, jihad can come in the form of war. So I'm not sure how you separate that, but the war component of it is a very tiny part of it.
Okay. Let's go back to the phones. This is Patrick in Ellsworth. Patrick, good afternoon. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of take it from a religious discussion to a geopolitical one. Okay. I think there's this common misconception amongst Americans that Islam is inherently does not like Western society. And we tend to forget about, you know, the Mujahideen and overthrowing the Shah. And it seems now with our continued military involvement in the Middle East that we're kind of making repeated mistakes in American foreign policy. But at the same time, obviously, ISIS poses a serious threat, and we don't want to be completely isolationist. So I was just wondering what the panel thought about that, like applying this to a foreign policy standpoint from America's perspective, what they'd like to see moving forward.
Okay. Reza?
Well, the listener is absolutely right. In terms of the Taliban, that would be a wonderful example, if it can be called that. Afghanistan used to be this very peaceful Muslim country. And because it did not have, was not rich in oil, it was almost left alone. And in the late 70s, it was invaded by the Red Army, the Russians. And we tend to forget that. That Russians invaded Afghanistan, the peaceful neighbor to the south, and occupied Afghanistan. And the U.S., in their desire to get rid of the Russians and Red Army and send them back to Russia, offered support, military and financial support, to the freedom fighters called Mujahideen. And once the Mujahideen fought back and resisted the occupation, and they were heroes in this country. But the moment they started turning against us, who had financed and sent them arms, we started calling them the terrorists, and they became what we now refer to as the Taliban. The point I'm making is that Afghans continue to be Muslims prior to the invasion of Afghanistan and after Russians being sent back, and an arrival of the Taliban. Here we have a group of people who were financed and trained by us to fight the Russians, and they became extremely violent, and they mistakenly claim to represent Islam and claim that they're fighting for God. And as moderate Muslims, we would disagree with them. And we would call that a political, really the political aspect of Islam rather than the faith itself.
Okay. Go ahead, Ali.
I think 2 points, Erwin. I believe that first thing is we need to demystify Islam and separate it from the political use of it, and also discover not only the diversity and the complexity of Muslim societies and how these groups are really using and abusing the faith for their own political reasons, but also discover our own government involvement in the countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and other places, and also the struggle of the ordinary people trying to make sense of their lives and have a normal life for them and their families. And the second thing is also important is we have to remember that this is not new. Catholics in this country, in the United States, in the 19th century, late 19th century, the beginning of 19th century, were also a problem. People looked at them as really our suspect, our authoritarian. They are, you know, hostage to the Pope. They're going to be subverting American democracy. And I think that will help understand it. At the same time, also not be fooled by these groups who are targeting Muslim societies themselves. I think there is no escape. We are interconnected with the Muslim world, sometimes through this really threat of this violent group, but hopefully we'll discover the through learning, mutual learning, mutual education between us and them, that there are many, many commonalities that will help us maybe coexist together and find commonalities instead of just this threat that's emerging now. And hopefully the crisis will become something positive where we re-educate ourselves as we ask them to be also educating themselves about us.
I'm down to just a minute to go, but a couple of people have called and kind of asked the same question. Is there more that the Muslim community needs to do to kind of counter what is being done by groups like ISIS? Do they need to be more aggressive in speaking out about what's being done?
I think you see both of us nodding, and my answer would be yes, we need to do more. We need to raise our voices, but it's also unfair to put all the burden on so-called Muslim moderates. We also need to really learn about Islam, its beauty. Every religion is beautiful and peaceful. It's always, we need to be mindful that there are elements within every religion that tends to be violent. And once we separate them from one another and not judge the entire community by actions of few, I think we'll be fine.
All right.
I certainly would think that the moderate Muslims in the Muslim countries need to be very careful, because the Sunni and the Shia will continue to kill each other.
All right. We have to leave it there. Reza, John, Ali, and Omar in Bangor, thank you all very much for joining us. Omar Kunte, Outreach Coordinator at the Islamic Center in Orono. Ali Amida, a professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of New England. Reza Jalali, Coordinator of the Multicultural Student Affairs at the University of Southern Maine. And John Michaud, Director and Assistant Professor of the School of Legal Studies at Hudson University. John Keimel ran the board today. Volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls. We had help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. And a reminder that you've been listening to Maine Calling on MPBN. I'm Erwin Gratz. Thank you and have a nice afternoon.